Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome.
Listeners, we have a very special bonus interview for you all today, but actually, this is also kind of a sneak peek of a full episode we're currently finishing up, inspired by our conversation with Emily Beeney, Chief Curator at the Legion of Honor and Fine Arts Museum in San Francisco, on the Mary Cassatt exhibition At Work. Mary Cassatt, as in the Impressionist painter, who is mostly known for her bebes and portraits of upper-class women, an artist I was obviously aware of, but I had totally overlooked.
Mary and the Cassettes, would have been like a really good band name in like 2003. Cassatt is definitely like a goat painter, in my opinion.
Yes, yes.
So I'm surprised that you did not know about her.
Listen.
Or overlooked her.
I know. She is goat, but you also see all of these...
I don't think you know she is goat.
She is goat. I know now. I have learned. You just see all these wealthy women, okay, and their babies. Okay. And I'm just like, this is not something that I can personally relate to.
Right.
I'm neither wealthy nor mother.
Yeah. Wealthy nor a mother, nor... Yeah, exactly. Look, I mean, I get on the surface, it's just like upper class layabouts, like, and they're
laying about,
and their seed, their children, their seed, their spawn. But I mean, I feel the same way about her as I do John Singer Sargent, whose paintings I also find mostly completely unrelatable. But you have to have respect for the game, Stephanie. The painting game. They're good painters.
Yes, they're good painters.
You study the good painters, even if it's a little bit boring. But you know, even I was surprised. There was a lot about her I just did not know because I guess I overlooked her biography. I didn't care too much about that. I was just looking at the surface.
Okay.
Surface value.
Okay, gotcha.
The nice little paint marks.
I honestly think...
Twists of the wrists.
Yeah, I'm still processing the twists of the wrists. But I'll say this. If you think you know Mary Cassatt... No, you don't.
Okay.
There is this whole other layer to her work that completely blew me away, and it adds all of this new context that I, again, am still processing.
Mary definitely had a leg up in some ways, but she also had a lot stacked against her, and she worked hard, like more than I ever knew, to validate art as labor, which is typically treated as this hobby or noble pursuit that is not worth receiving food for or shelter for or healthcare for, right? And she actually really chose to show like unseen labor in her paintings too. That stuff I was totally not aware of.
Yep.
It's not like an exact one-to-one on what artists face today, but I'm sure you artist listeners will find something delicious, just a morsel of deliciousness to chew on from this interview.
Once again, the exhibition is called Mary Cassatt at Work, and it's open until January 26, 2025. So go out and see it for yourself.
And like we said, we're going to have an actual full episode on Mary Cassatt. We kind of took a strange path. We took a strange path, so it took a little bit longer than we wanted it to take. I hope you all are going to enjoy that. Coming out very soon, Kuniyoshi Part 2, also coming out very soon. Check that out.
And if you missed our Yasuo Kuniyoshi Part 1 and La Katrina episodes that dropped a few weeks ago, go give them a watch or a listen. In the meantime, let's get into it. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and comment. We are trying to grow our visual reach here, okay? Thank you.
Hey, if you're a podcast listener and you're not watching, I don't know, put it on before you go to bed or something. Who cares?
Please.
Give us a little help. We'd
appreciate
it.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. Au revoir.
We'll see you on the flip side. Actually, no. This is the last time you'll see us in this episode, except for the pre-recorded part, which we're about to play. Okay. Love you. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Listeners, viewers, we would like to give an Art Slice welcome to Emily Beeney, Chief Curator at the Legion of Arts in San Francisco. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We are here to talk about Mary Cassatt, who is the focus of the upcoming exhibition, Mary Cassatt at Work, which recently opened at the Legion of Honor in San Francisco, which you can catch, listeners, until January 26th of next year.
I don't want to speak for Stephanie, but I know she's been one of my favorite artists for a long time, like ever since I saw Little Girl in the Blue Armchair, I think is the title. I printed it out like back in the, you know, getting, well, back when like...
We printed stuff.
When you would print out JPEGs, yeah. Definitely holds a place in my heart. And we were also like super excited because the exhibition is about different types of labor, which we'll get into, but including often like labor that is overlooked in society. So, and still overlooked in society. So it seems like a really incredible show.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary exhibition. So sort of developed by colleagues of ours in Philadelphia, Laurel Gerber and Jennifer Thompson at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And we're thrilled to be able to give it a West Coast showing. It's an exhibition that's really sort of the first monographic retrospective treatment of this major artist in fully a generation. And it explores the question of work, both in terms of the work of making art, you know, the marks of the artist's brush and etching needle and fingertips on the surfaces of her works, and from the standpoint of kind of the iconography of work. So the representation, especially of women's work, from knitting and needlepoint to nursing infants and bathing children.
Yeah. And on that note, we actually were wondering how much of that subject matter that she depicted, which, you know, the women, the children, the caregivers, the mothers, how much of that was actually by choice? Like, was it because of her gender or her social status, or was it completely by choice?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors, right? You know, she's cognizant of being a woman from a specific social class, just as she's cognizant of being an American living in France, with the sort of privileges and the constrictions that came along with those sort of elements of her status and identity. She definitely, you know, is spending a lot of time among other upper middle class, other wealthy women and their household employees. So none of these is a sort of transparent document of life just as she observed it, because, of course, these are carefully orchestrated scenes in her studio. She hires professional models. She sets it all up. But they are scenes, I think, that speak to her insight, most especially into children and the work of caring for them.
That's super interesting. I didn't realize she hired professional models. I thought she just kind of used whoever was around her, which I'm sure she was surrounded by plenty of people. So that's really cool. I wonder how she distinguished who she was going to use for what composition.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, quite early in her career, I think we do see more depictions, especially of her sister, Lydia, whom she uses as, you know, sort of a free model quite a bit. But she cuts a deal pretty early on in her career with her father that her own art had to pay for itself. Mm. So although she, you know, has some financial independence coming from a well-to-do family, she needed, according to this deal, to sell her art in order to cover the costs of running a studio, materials, models, and so on, which I think has the effect of helping her really kind of professionalize her practice quite rapidly at the beginning of her career. And yeah, she does have favorite paid models, some of whom were no doubt full-time professional models or women who modeled for other artists, and then some of whom were domestic employees, either within her own household or the households of her friends, whom she paid to pose for her. I think it's interesting that many of these sort of mother and child scenes, which she was very happy to title and exhibit and certainly to sell as scenes of mothers and children, very few of them actually represent mothers with their own children. Mostly what we're seeing are the children of Cassatt's friends and family, so upper middle class children, often represented with paid professional models as their adult caregivers.
I just wanted to take it back a little bit. How did Mary Cassatt get involved with the Impressionists? Because it's pretty unusual. There weren't many women Impressionists that were part of the mostly male group. And certainly she wasn't from Paris. So how did that come about?
Yeah, so she's exhibiting her own work at the Salon, the big, at that point, annual state-sponsored exhibition in Paris, where she has received serious sort of academically oriented training from official artists like Charles Chaplin and Jean-Léon Gérôme and Thomas Couture. But it's really seeing her work at the Salon. Degas says, supposedly, there's somebody who thinks the way I do. And this is really sort of the beginning of what becomes one of the richest and most collaborative friendships in the life of either one of those two artists. And it results in Cassatt's invitation to exhibit with the Impressionists, which she starts to do in 1879, joining them for, let's see, their fourth exhibition, their fourth joint exhibition. So as you know, the Impressionist group does have one female founding member starting in 1874, and that's Berthe Morisot, mm-hmm. on whom I'm preparing an exhibition that will happen.
Oh, nice.
Ooh, that's exciting. That's super exciting.
Was she related to Manet? Is that Stephanie's the art historian. I'm not the
art
historian.
I had a little bit of tea. She was a sister, his sister-in-law, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So Morisot is the sister-in-law of Manet. And our exhibition will actually be about that relationship. So Manet and Morisot.
Oh, wow.
Which is another one of these super close collaborative relationships that's really marked by mutual influence. And there's never been a major international loan exhibition about it. So.
Ooh, that's super exciting. Yeah. I didn't realize they also had a close relationship. Well, Morisot and Manet, but Degas and Cassatt as well. And she was very creative. I mean, during their friendship, right? Because she started printmaking and she started even experimenting with like metallic paint. So all these facts blew my mind. Like, I didn't know this much about Mary Cassatt, and I love it. I'm here for it.
Yeah, Kimberly Jones, a wonderful colleague at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, did a sort of path-breaking exhibition about Degas and Cassatt together a little over a decade ago, I think. And that really sort of teased out how much each is learning from the other, how much each is pushing the other to experiment, especially with new materials like, you know, glue-based paint or metallic paint, and to do weird, wild things with their prints.
Yeah, that was something that really struck me about her work was not only did she just have an amazing output, just like that's one, I guess, one aspect to the at work, if you will. So it definitely was like a labor of creation. As you mentioned, like she was also selling her work, so that was super important. But she constantly kept reinventing herself. And that's something just as someone who has come into contact with mostly her paintings at museums, like I didn't realize like how much other work she was doing, how much like she got involved with printmaking, got involved with the journal, I guess it was, that never came to fruition. Yeah, she has a whole other side of her career that's, I guess, not that well known that seems like comes out in this exhibition.
I think that's really true. You know, I think her achievements as a printmaker are maybe the most astonishing piece of the puzzle in this exhibition. She, you know, starts making etchings and aquatints, definitely accelerating those experiments as she and Degas and Pissarro, and another member of the Impressionist group, plan this journal that they're going to publish together called Le Jour et la Nuit, you know, Day and Night. And it was meant to be all, you know, black and white imagery. It doesn't come to fruition, but that drives enormous sort of creativity among this group of printmakers. And then she sort of changes gears at the end of the 1880s in her printmaking practice, veers away from kind of tonal and atmospheric and kind of inky, murky effects that she'd been kind of courting in her works a decade earlier, towards these super spare linear prints, these dry points, you know, that involve sort of direct scratching with a needle into uncoated copper plate. And the effect is a little bit like Renaissance metal point drawings. I mean, they're such sort of pure, clean designs, highly detailed, super precise, that showcase her tremendous skill as a draftswoman, which, you know, was a distinguishing feature of her work as a woman, because very few women artists of her time received quite such rigorous training in drawing, especially in drawing the figure, as she had received. And then finally, probably her greatest contribution to the story of printmaking, and one of the monuments in the history of modern printmaking, really, is what's called the Set of Ten. So this is a group of 10 color prints that emerges actually from her encounter with an exhibition of Japanese prints that she sees at the École des Beaux-Arts. And, you know, so these are, you know, ukiyo-e woodblock prints in, you know, bright colors, showing scenes from everyday life, often particularly the everyday lives of women in Edo, Japan. And she's sort of entranced by this. And she comes out of the exhibition, writes a letter actually to Berthe Morisot, to her fellow Impressionist, saying, "I'm dreaming of color on copper." Ooh. And what she means by that is that she's going to try to reverse engineer this process using traditional Western intaglio techniques. So she's going to try to produce the effect of a Japanese print on the copper plates used than European printmaking.
Oh, wow.
I love that.
And so she, I mean, by this point, she has gone whole hog. So she has a printing press at her studio, super unusual for the period. You know, it's like this giant, heavy, crazy piece of equipment that she has in her studio. And she hires in a master printer to help her figure out this reverse engineering process. His name is Modeste Leroy, and we actually have in the show, I think it's 12 states of her first print in this series that show this kind of process of trial and error as Cassatt and Leroy working together figure out for the first time how to make, you know, color prints on copper plates, how to sync up the multiple plates that hold the different colors, you know, which parts of the design should be held by aquatint. And it's really amazing to watch this composition evolve. And then it's very sweet, I think, that at the end, in the editioned final states of these prints, she signs them not only with her own name, but with the name of Modeste Leroy, with the name of her collaborator, who is this master printer, which is super unusual. You know, the work of master printers is usually rendered invisible. And so I think there, too, there's an interest in kind of acknowledging the shared labor.
Oh, that's super interesting. Yeah, because a lot of the Japanese prints, it was just by the name of the master, of course, not the people who helped in the studio. That's really great.
That is
that's
awesome. Great to hear.
One of the kind of interesting things about the set of 10 and the fact that we have all these states of the first print in that set of color prints, you know, that you can watch the composition evolve as she and Leroy sort of engage in this trial and error process. So they're arranged in two rows, these 12 versions of the composition. And the theme of the print, the subject of the print, is it's called the bath. And it's presumably a mother preparing to bathe a child. And the effect that it produces echoes, you know, the iterative nature of the experimental printmaking ends up echoing the iterative nature of bath time. So it's like bath time is something that happens again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And so I think there's something really interesting about our ability to kind of capture that through the installation itself. So it feels like a way in which Cassatt's labor as an artist ends up echoing the work involved in giving a child a bath.
And also, I think bathing was super important back then. Wasn't there like a public push to get people to bathe more at that time? I think hopefully not misremembering that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the sort of culture of certainly daily bathing arrives a little bit later in the 19th century in Paris. It's started to be adopted by well-to-do Americans a little bit earlier. And yeah, so it's definitely in the air, I guess, so to speak, in that moment with, you know, increasing availability of indoor plumbing and so on. So
she's kind of like pointing towards others. Like it's really interesting to see an artist, you know, especially an impressionist artist, talk about something that is overlooked, something that is political or deserves like a spotlight, I guess. In my mind, she's very different than many of the impressionists.
No, don't move. Stay very still. A little while longer, and I will surprise you.
We're talking generally about her work and, yeah, about some specific ones, but I'm really excited to get to A Good Night Hug. So this is a pastel from 1880. And I'm just going to give a quick description for those who are listening or who maybe aren't as familiar with the work. We have a cropped close-up of a woman, presumably a mother, with her arms wrapped around a small child. Her face is pressed up against the child's, so much so that we don't see either of their facial features. The mother and child are rendered more fully, some looser marks around the child. They are sitting in a blue armchair, and the background space is flattened, and it almost feels collaged, made up of a very vibrant pattern of vertical stripes and horizontal squiggles.
It has like this jangly texture that it looks like it's representing like a highly decorative wallpaper in a way, but it has this like depth to it that also takes it outside of that world too, which makes it this very, like, not hyper-specific, yet specific space. Mm-hmm. Almost like dreamlike or mm-hmm. like an overgrown forest you would see in a dream or something like that. Except you can only see so far until the, like, sunlight cuts out. So, yeah. And pastel.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
super hard to work with.
Absolutely. No, it's, I mean, you know, has this sort of friable texture that, of course, makes it magically spreadable and able to produce these velvety textures, but that also makes it easy to rub and smear and, you know, it makes many pastels sort of as fragile as a butterfly's wing. I think, you know, it is that tension between the sort of softness, the kind of melting, velvety qualities of pastel and its properties as a graphic medium, really different from smooth, creamy oil paint that I think tap into exactly what you're describing about the composition, that sort of contrast between the heat and softness of cheek against cheek, you know, the sense of almost of two beings merging into one, extraordinarily intimate embrace between the woman and child, and then the kind of electric handling of the background, you know, it's super open and graphic and sort of cursory. It feels like it was done in a big hurry. It's interesting, you know, this wallpaper, actually the same wallpaper appears in several of her compositions. And so when you recognize it, you think, oh yeah, that is that same wallpaper. But the way that she's rendered it here, I mean, it's almost abstract. There are like little abstract expressionist paintings to be found within details of this sheet. It's an amazing thing. So she shows it with the Impressionists at their sixth exhibition in 1881. And everyone's sort of astonished by this, you know, it garners really kind of rave reviews for the quality of her draftsmanship, but also for this kind of amazingly frank treatment of this borderline. I mean, I use this word not at all in a sexual way, but this almost sort of like carnal, you know, it's like flesh to flesh of connection.
Yeah.
Do we know if that was one of her models or the patrons, I guess, I don't want to say nannies or au pairs or whatever the term was back then?
Yeah, I mean, the costume this woman is wearing suggests to me that she may well be a member of domestic staff, but, you know, we're not offered a ton of specifics.
Sure.
Yeah, I love how with any medium, she's able to capture the tenderness between, I mean, just like a mother figure and a child. I don't know how long it took her to make this. Who knows? Because she's got the mixture of the zigzags, but then she kind of, you know, her marks get tighter within the figures. But even with like the combination of both, she still does such a good job of capturing them like they're in a moment. I kept saying to Russell, I used to nanny. And I have a niece. So like, I know like how kids are moving. I know that this kid is probably squirming, but he's also like leaning in for the kiss. Like, I know exactly what's happening. And I don't get that with a lot of painters, not even the Impressionists. So her works just blow my mind. Like any medium, she still manages to capture, like you said, the carnal, that carnal aspect of it. So yeah, I love this piece. So thank you for suggesting it.
Hooray. I mean, yeah, I think it's just amazing. And I think it also kind of typifies the way that sometimes those tightly worked areas that you're pointing to, you know, in the faces and the hair, it's like we're almost more astonished and impressed by the naturalism of those moments because they're surrounded by these more openly worked areas, these more rapidly sketched passages, that it's like she sort of shows her hand. She shows us, here's how I did it. And yet it's still sort of like miraculous that anyone could do it. She sort of lets us look over her shoulder, and yet exactly how she's able to capture a moment like this remains mysterious.
The way they emerge from from that sort of background or patterning, whatever you want to call it, reminds me a lot of like Sargent's work, where it almost felt like, you know, his brushstrokes would take on a mind of their own. And there was this kind of wrestling back and forth. It's a little bit different, but it's very, very similar in the way that like the final image like emerges from just like what could very easily just be abstract. And then something that Stephanie, you said, made a little light bulb go off for me. It basically like talks about the show as a whole too, because you're seeing what is possibly like a domestic worker, really giving a lot of love and actual warmth to a child who may or may not be theirs, which, you know, speaks to just that kind of work and how much of yourself you actually have to pour into it. And then, like, when you see, like, her depiction of the work, especially, like, in the child's, like, head, there's something, like, really magical about the way that she paints that hair, or not paints, but depicts that hair, especially, like, that we know from children, like, they have that sort of, like, thin, almost translucent hair at that age. And she depicts it perfectly. It also shows, like, this sort of, like, care from her own, like, vision as an artist to, like, just be able to notice those warm moments that you see all the time and just, like, depict them so effortlessly. Can't talk.
Cassatt's insight into children is just so special. I mean, into their inner lives, into the way that they move their bodies and hands, into things like the texture of, you know, a toddler's hair. It's just, I'm not sure that there, you know, I am sure, in fact, that there was no one before her in the history of Western art with quite this same kind of insight into and attention paid to very small children.
And that's fascinating because she chose not to have children either, right? She chose her career, which is also, that also is just fascinating. Also, we don't have children, and yet I can appreciate these tender moments. I can appreciate all of these portraits. So I can only imagine that a mother would love these even more to see that labor, that care that only, you know, a mother can experience in that certain way be depicted in a painting on a museum wall.
Yeah, I think it is a really an interesting fact about Cassatt that she herself does not marry, does not have children. And I do think that, you know, for a woman of her time and class, unfortunately, the kind of professional ambitions that she had were just totally incompatible with any aspect of family life. You know, so whether she would have made a different choice today, I can't say, but it is, you know, but she did also just lead a life that was also full of children, nevertheless.
Yeah.
We know that she kept toys in her studio to keep them occupied, you know, so that they would sit and play so that she could draw and paint them. Supposedly, she tended to lose interest in her nieces and nephews as they sort of approached their tweens. She was most interested in depicting quite small children. But yeah, it is a really interesting fact, I think, to grapple with. And certainly, I think in no way diminishes how important a lot of these works have been for parents over the generations. You know, I think that for a lot of people, they've felt kind of seen in the difficulties and joys of raising small children by Cassatt's work. You know, idealized though, of course, it so often is. But, you know, I think many people have felt seen as parents by these works in a way that no prior works of art in the Western canon have, you know, made them feel seen.
We sometimes babysit our niece. And I would have loved to have seen, like, this is obviously like a revisionist history, but I would have loved to have seen Mary Cassatt like paint like the messy moments too, like when the child's like just misbehaving, like it's got a rash, it's like waking up at 2 a.m.
Oh yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, I think there's some idealization that goes on for sure, and some scholars have pointed out the interesting differences between the way that Marizot, you know, her impressionist colleague who did have a daughter, which the representation of sort of childcare and the way that Cassatt represents it. You know, I think it's very interesting to try to read in biography into these works, but I don't know that it's possible to do it in a way that's definitive.
Yeah, I think her work is also very timely as we have social media now and creators, people are posting those moments that we don't normally see. They're like, no, this is actually what it's like to be a mother. It's not just, you know, the kiss goodnight or, you know, all the pretty things. It's also the, like we said, the challenges, the dirty diapers, all those things. So I really do think people are talking more about domestic labor and recognizing it now more than ever. So I think this show is, the timing is great. It's perfect. I also feel for artist mothers too, trying to make it work, having a child and, you know, still make your career successful.
Yeah, especially if you're not wealthy. it must be really difficult.
Yeah.
I know we have some listeners who are definitely mothers, and it would be interesting to see how, you know, an artist who isn't a big timer deals with having children and making work at the same time. I know it's a lot of work. It must be a lot of work.
For our audio guide to our presentation of this exhibition in San Francisco, we reached out to members of a staff group here at the Fine Arts Museums who identify as caregivers in one way or another. Oh. Most of them are caring for children. Some of them are caring for aging parents. And we asked them to talk about some of the pictures in the show and, you know, from the kind of perspective of personal experience. And, you know, they shared some really extraordinarily personal insights into these works that I think will help visitors see them from lots of different angles. So, of course, we want people to understand these works from the kind of art historical perspective, but I think that it's also really interesting for people to consider them from a range of different sort of positional experiential kinds of angles.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's I love to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, some of the stories are just really very moving, you know, the ways that people are able to connect with these works.
It's also community building in a way, because the visitors, you know, they're visiting the museum and they're hearing from the staff members that work there in connection to the show that they are viewing. So I love that. That's such an awesome idea.
I mean, it's just, you know, this is a show that I think will have a lot of personal meaning for a lot of visitors. And of course, that's also true for a lot of members of staff. So
now here is an artist who thinks and feels things as I do. I have to meet the man responsible for such a wonderful painting.
Monsieur Degas. The painter is a woman. An American by the name of Mary Cassatt.
I can't stand the thought of a woman painting like that. She draws far too well.
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about, especially in installing kind of our last gallery of the show, because our installation here in San Francisco is mostly chronological. I've carved out a section that sort of explores the idea of finished and unfinished and when is a work of art finished, because this is something that I think Cassatt really played with. But the final gallery of the exhibition includes really work from the last decade or so of her activity before her sort of failing eyesight prevents her from continuing to paint. And, you know, the late work is often looked down on by art historians. Art historians often prefer the Impressionist period and consider the late stuff sort of commercial or kitschy or something. Because it is true that she has like tapped into a vein and, you know, found her groove, found her market. But it's really interesting to me to think about the contemporaneity of the late sort of modern Madonna paintings, the, you know, mother and child paintings of her last decade. The contemporaneity of those works to the Mont Saint-Victoire of Cézanne, the water lilies of Monet. Those two are artists who are returning again and again and again and again to the same theme, just as Cassatt is doing with the mother and child theme. But because Cassatt's chosen theme is so sort of freighted with gendered meaning, I think it's easier to kind of write it off and not recognize how she turns that subject into a locus for continued formal experimentation, just as Monet is doing with water lilies, just as Cézanne is doing, you know, with his beloved mountain. And so I think that's worth considering as visitors come through the show, and especially as they experience that last space. You know, thinking about this as, yeah, it's not just that she's figured out she can sell these things. It's also that this is a subject of great interest to her and within which she finds kind of endless variety.
That's wonderful. I didn't know about that either. the modern Madonna. No, I love to hear when people have their mountain or their lilies or, yeah, in her case, the the modern Madonna. I wonder what ours will be. I don't know if we mentioned we are artists. So listening to Mary Cassatt talk about how painting like takes it out of her, it's like, hell yeah. Yes, it does. Yeah. And I'm glad she's talking about it. I love all of these quotes from her because it really humanizes her for us artists. It's like, yeah, it's a lot of work. Art a lot of times is overlooked as well as labor. It's like, oh, you can just whip one up, right? No, actually, we can't. This actually is hours and hours and hours of thinking and then doing. So yeah, I really appreciated reading that about her. For sure.
Even some of the shit talking, like when she was talking about other artists, like not being like full.
The amateurs, like amateurs.
Like amateurs. She said, yeah. It was like, okay. Yeah. It's like, that's not very nice, but it's relatable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she really wants to distinguish herself especially as a woman, because the danger,
of
course, of being written off as sort of like an amateur lady painter, you know, a dilettante. was pretty high. So.
Oh.
Yeah, and to double down on the feminine subject matter is pretty bold too.
Yeah.
Especially when
Oh, I really appreciate her sticking to her guns. I didn't realize how much of an activist she was with the suffrage movement, and that she disowned her family for being anti-suffrage. Did I misremember?
It's a cause that becomes really important to her, especially in the last, in the final years of her life. And it's, it's a conviction that she shares with Louisine Havemeyer, a sort of collector and society leader in New York, whose great collection of Impressionist pictures, largely formed on Cassatt's advice, forms the kernel of the holdings of the Metropolitan Museum of Art today. But together, they work to organize an exhibition of works by Cassatt and Degas that's held in New York to benefit women's suffrage in 1915, I believe. And just what I love about that is Degas didn't believe in women's suffrage. Yeah. But Cassatt just like sort of drafts him into the cause. And he didn't have to know, I think he was really following him to New York that closely. So.
No, she's great. Yeah, like I said, I didn't realize she had all these sides to her, which of course she does. She's, she's a human being and she's an artist. But to hear about it, to know about it, to see it, and to speak to, people like you who know so much about it is also, it's great. It's great. I don't know what else to say about it. My brain is just, I'm so excited about this show. And Mary Cassatt, I don't want to say I overlooked her, but I just think when I was in school, I just think I wasn't looking at Impressionism. But it's really funny looking back now to these artists in art history, now that more is coming out about them too. It's just like, geez, I slept on that. I needed to go back and revisit that. So she's one of them. So I'm super excited. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, a lot of us maybe have this kind of like idea of Cassatt that's based on like a coffee mug and a poster in a dentist's waiting room.
Yeah.
For sure. It's easy to lose track of her original radicalism, just that she was making wild stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully this show will help people rediscover her sort of unruliness.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think, the way she's overlooked and like someone like Sargent isn't is a shame. Mm-hmm. Like I was mentioning, I think they have very, not similar, but similar approaches to bringing harmony out of some chaos. So, I'm excited to see it. I'm sure we'll make it down there, over there. I guess not down there, but to see it. See how it's doing.
By all means.
Yeah.
Love to have you.